Hello, good evening, everybody. Thank you so much for coming. It's great to see you all here. My name is Konrad Aleksandrovich, and I'm the director of the play you're going to see this evening, The Mad Woman of Chaillot. I'm also an associate professor here in the department, and I teach in the area of physical theater. So I teach the physical side of acting, and in my classes, students do a lot of creation of original work and a lot of skills building so that they can be more effective actors on the stage. So I'm going to talk to you about the playwright, Jean Giraudoux, and about the circumstances under which the play was written. I'm going to talk about the play itself, and I'm going to also talk to you about my approach, the approach that I and the designers took to staging this work, and the reasons why I made the choices that I did. I'm going to be reading mostly from a text. I hope I don't speak too quickly. I have a very fast internal energy, so I speak very fast. I'll try to keep my tempo reasonable. I'm just going to plunge in here, and hopefully we'll have some time for some questions at the end. Hippolyte, I get to speak French, which is great, because I used to be bilingual, and since I moved to the west of Canada, my French began to sort of decay, because we don't speak French so much here, but it's really is wonderful to speak French. Okay, so Hippolyte Jean Giraudoux was born on October 29th, 1882, in Bellac, in France, in the area called Limousin, which I think is where a limousine comes from. But I have to check into the connection there. He died January 31st, 1944, in Nazi-occupied Paris. So he didn't live to see either the premiere of his play or the liberation of Paris from the Nazis, which is very sad. He made his living as a diplomat. He worked and traveled all over the world, but he was also a novelist, essayist, and playwright who created an impressionistic form of drama by emphasizing dialogue and style rather than realism. It's interesting to note that the Baron, whom you will see right at the beginning of the play in the first scene, who's sitting at the table, who meets the president and the prospector, his name, although it's not spoken in the play, is Jean Hippolyte. And I think that that's not an accident at all. I think it's pretty clear that the character of the Baron is basically a stand-in for the playwright. And as you'll see, and it was very difficult for the actor to work out how to play this character because really all he does is observe the action and ask questions. That's what he's doing the whole play. So he's sort of he is definitely the playwright character in the script. Giraudoux's father was a surveyor and later worked as a tax collector, and Giraudoux himself distinguished himself both academically and as an athlete. In 1900, he won a scholarship to the Lycée Lacanal in Paris. And I want to just point out a very important sort of element in his education here for the sake of his relationship with Germany, for example. When he was at this school, he was fortunate enough to have as his German master a man named Charles Andler, who, as well as inculcating in him a deep knowledge and feeling for the language and literature, inspired him with a love of Germany. So Giraudoux loved German Romanticism. He loved Schiller and Goethe. And I want to say something about this while I'm on this subject. He believed in that everything, that people and countries had sort of essential natures, an idea that we don't believe in anymore. So he believed that Germany had its true essential nature was something poetic and beautiful and inspiring, and that what happened when Germany became militarized was that it lost its contact with its true nature and became something monstrous in the world. But it's really important to remember that he had a tremendous love for Germany. He went to the École Normale in Paris. They have a whole different educational system in France, which I'm not going to try to explain. I don't really understand it, but it's different. After he completed his École Normale education, he was offered a teaching, what's called a lectorat, at the University of Munich. So he actually spent a year in Munich. He loved Munich. He went to all the art galleries. I was just in Munich this past summer, and it's a fantastic city, as maybe some of you know. And then he embarked on all kinds of travels. So he traveled he was actually a lecturer in French at Harvard, and he traveled throughout the USA and Canada. So there's a whole story of Giraudoux in Canada, which somebody might want to look into at some point. After that, he worked for 3 years for Le Matin in Paris, and then he decided to join the civil service. So he took this test you have to take. He sat this examination, and he joined the diplomatic service, and he spent the rest of his life in the diplomatic service, but he was writing on the side. And if you think about it, that's a pretty good day job if you're a writer. You know, he probably had a lot of time to write. So that's not meant to be a cut at diplomats, but he managed to write a lot. So I think he made it work. He became known as an avant-garde writer with a group of early poetic novels. His early works were considered difficult, far-fetched, and precious. But the word precious is translated from the French word précieuse and from the noun préciosité, and that means something quite different in French, and I want to share that with you. This is from an introduction to the French version of the play called La Folle de Chaillot by a man named DJ Conlon. Giraudoux's remarkable subtlety of mind and felicity of expression often led him to indulge in that refinement and artificiality of language known as preciosity, which means that he was involved in all kinds of wordplay. And you'll see this in the play. You'll see that every now and then, quite regularly, the whole momentum of the story is suspended when some character comes on and does something that obviously he thought was funny and beautiful and poetic and charming, but it doesn't advance the plot. And you kind of have to just go along with that. And I hope that we've made that interesting enough for you as an audience that you won't just sort of tune out. But you will really notice when the wheels of the plot just kind of stop and this wacky character starts telling the story to the audience. So the play is full of that kind of thing. The writer goes on to say, unfortunately, preciosity leads only too easily to stylistic excesses, and Giraudoux tends to play the role of a literary juggler who has tossed too many brightly colored verbal balls in the air and finds that he is unable to retrieve them without dropping them all. And speaking of, there's supposed to be a juggler in this show, and we can find anybody who could juggle. So during the broker's speech, which you will not be able to miss, I'm not going to give away anything more about it, but you will not miss the broker. I had to find some kind of replacement for juggling, and you'll see what that is. His most famous novel was called Siegfried et le Limousin from 1922, in which he depicted in silhouette, as it were, the hostility between two long-standing enemies, France and Germany, as a background to his story of a man who suffers from amnesia. Thus, what was to become the central theme of Giraudoux's plays was made clear, a pair of opposites, whatever they might be, man and God in his play Amphitryon 38 from 1929, man and woman in Sodom et Gomorrah from 1943, or the world of paganism and the world of the Old Testament in Judith in 1931. But his career in theater began really in 1928 when he adapted Siegfried et le Limousin through a whole very complicated process of revisions and rewritings into a play called Siegfried, and that was his first play. He was introduced to the illustrious actor and director Louis Jouvet, who has an amazing career himself. He was one of the actors who worked with the theater visionary named Jacques Copeau. Jacques Copeau is a really big name in French theater in the early 20th century. He had a company called Les Vieux Colombiers, which was very influential in rethinking the way theater could be imagined and staged. And Jouvet directed all of Giraudoux's plays. They had a relationship that went right to the end of his life. So he directed all of his plays. And I think they had probably had a... It's wonderful when an artist finds a partner like that. And I think it's actually quite inspiring to think that they had this really good relationship that persisted all through these years. With the exception of a play called Intermezzo, he never worked with an original subject. He was always working from existing sources. And he found inspiration in classical or biblical traditions, such as the story of Electra, the Song of Songs. He adapted Margaret Kennedy's novel, The Constant Nymph, in his play Tessa, la nymphe au cœur fidèle, and La Motte Fouquet's fairy tale of a water sprite who loves a mortal man as Undine. Undine is also, that's an ancient story. It's an opera. Maybe you know of, I don't know who wrote the opera, but it's definitely an opera among other media. Among Giraudoux's other important works, combining tragedy, humor, and fantasy, rendered in a style of exceptional virtuosity, are La Guerre de Troie n'aura pas lieu, which means The Trojan War Will Not Take Place, adapted in English by Christopher Fry as The Tiger at the Gates, which argues that wars originate from small details interpreted as good or bad by those who are supposedly doing what is best, and of course The Madwoman of Chaillot, which this is the French version, and I was astonished to when I picked it up to discover that there are speeches that go on for, you can't see this, but this is one speech. So it's incredibly verbose. And this man, Maurice Valency, did this incredible job of translating and adapting the play from French into English in 1947. And when I first read the English version, which of course you're going to see, I was struck by how playable it is, how deft it is, how clever and how contemporary it is as well. So that's the version that most of us know because the play has been performed a lot in English-speaking countries and, of course, where they don't speak French. Let's see now. In his plays, Giraudoux tries to resolve the conflict between opposites by bringing them into contact with each other. By this means, he explores such fundamental dualities as war and peace, life and death, man and woman, and finally the meaning of human destiny. He treats these serious themes, however, not through a realistic depiction of psychological conflict, but rather through a process of investigation, discussion, and reflection that is communicated to the audience through his characters' recitatives and badinage. So, actually, I would say that they're more, because the recitative is all about dialogue in opera. These are more like arias. I want to give you an example of what I'm talking about here. And we have a very funny actor in the fourth year class whose name is Duncan Alexander, who does a magnificent job with his character. His name is, in the middle of this proceeding where something really significant has happened, this character named Dr. Jadin has shown up, and he begins to sort of declaim that as the policeman brings on the supposedly drowned figure of this man named Pierre, who is a very important character in the story, Dr. Jadin interjects and says, "One moment, please, one moment. I don't like to interfere, but it's my professional duty to point out that medical science has definitely established the fact of intrauterine respiration. Consequently, this policeman, even before he was born, knew not only how to breathe, but how to cough, hiccup, and belch." The president says, "Suppose he did. How does that concern you?" Dr. Jadin goes on, "On the other hand, medical science has never established the fact of intrauterine swimming or diving. Under the circumstances, we are forced to the opinion, officer, that if you dive in, you will probably drown." So there's this whole sort of comic play that's going on here, which has nothing to do with the story at all. But we're supposed to enjoy the comedy as we are passing through all of this. Giraudoux's language is lyrical, poetic, rich with metaphors, paradoxes, and allusions. The sense of humor so evident in his plays is marked by brilliant wit and a devastating sense of the absurd. The Madwoman of Chaillot. I'm now going to talk about the play more in detail. In spite of having seen the rise of the National Socialist Party firsthand as a diplomat in Germany and having watched his beloved Paris invaded by an occupying army, for Parisians this was a humiliating nightmare. There are lots of images of people weeping in the streets, watching the Nazis were the greatest force for evil the world's ever seen. I'm of an age where my parents were profoundly affected by the Nazis. My mother was English and lived through the Blitzkrieg in London, and my father was Polish, who escaped the Panzer advance across Poland. So in my family, we grew up with this shadow that had occurred in the world, which was Nazism. So it was a particular irony when these goose-stepping troops march into Paris, which of course is a city that we associate with the sort of highest expressions of beauty, of the imagination, of love, right? City of light, the city of love. So it was a heartbreaking thing for the population, of course. Despite this, he had not lost his faith in the basic goodness of mankind, and he spins a beautiful vision of the world through the words of the Countess Aurelia, who is really a wonderful character, I think you'll agree. And maybe you've seen this play before, so you know what I'm talking about. And also through the vagabonds, who are drawn with great tenderness and compassion. Despite his transcendent, almost mystical view of life, Giraudoux remains grounded in reality, and in The Madwoman, he offers a practical, if outrageous, solution to the problem he postulates. How do we combat the evil that is taking over the world and robbing us of our happiness? Her response is to get rid of all the evil people at once, after a fair trial, of course. And the play seems to be asking this question. Is it right and just for the better part of humanity, what Abraham Lincoln called the better angels of our nature, which encompasses the capacity to love, to make art, to live according to the promptings of our imagination, and that aligns itself with the life force in the world, is it right and just for this part to kill off its shadow side, that which expresses itself through the seven deadly sins, for example, especially greed, in order to save the world? In other words, what will we do to save the world from evil? What measures will we take? One could argue, however, that in doing this, these better angels of our nature have disappeared, which is why we give voice in a democracy, even to those who, if they took power, would try to wipe it out. Why we, at least in some countries, have abolished the death penalty, why we maintain that we ought not to engage in an eye for an eye justice, even when dealing with, for example, the fighters of IS or Daesh, given what they have done in the world in the last 6 years in the Middle East, where we've got to see sort of the similar atrocities practiced, although with much more sort of much less industrialized sort of mechanized uniformity, but still at the same level of savagery that is so extreme it's hard even to comprehend. At the time of Madwoman's writing, Paris was an occupied city in the middle of Nazi-occupied northern and western France, the zone occupée. The Nazis had conquered France very quickly. In 6 weeks from the 10th of May, 1940, German forces, as they did in Poland, they just crashed through the Low Countries. They defeated the Allied forces very quickly, and they overwhelmed France, Belgium, Luxembourg, and the Netherlands. The south was under the control of the Vichy government, which was a client state of the Nazis, basically, known as the Zone Libre, or Free France. To many in the outside world, the Nazi occupation of Paris seemed to have no cultural impact. Parisians were very proud of the fact that, in spite of the ever-present swastika, the show went on. Theaters were full, galleries remained open. Marcel Carnet created his extraordinary film classic, Les Enfants du Paradis. How many people here have seen Les Enfants du Paradis, The Children of Paradise? Anybody? A few hands. So this film, with its huge scenes and thousands of extras, was made during the Nazi occupation. It's kind of hard to imagine that. But the truth, however, was darker and subtler. As Jean-Paul Sartre writes in his essay, Paris Under Occupation, quote, in Avenue Foch, we would hear from neighboring buildings all day long and late into the night, cries and suffering and terror. There was nobody in Paris who did not have a relative or friend arrested or deported or shot. It appeared that there were hidden holes in the city and that it emptied itself through these holes as if from an internal and incurable hemorrhage. We spoke little of it at the time, even more than with the famine. We hid this uninterrupted bleeding, partially out of prudence, partially out of dignity. Unquote. But in The Madwoman of Chaillot, we see a Paris as if the occupation were only a passing figment of the imagination, a bad dream that from once awakened would soon be forgotten in the light of day. Jean Giraudoux wrote his comedic fable about good and evil in difficult conditions and ill health in 1943 and 44. Unfortunately, he did not live to see its premiere. The Madwoman of Chaillot was first produced in the original French, La Folle de Chaillot, in 1945, 2 years after his death and just after World War II had ended in Europe. The playwright's longtime collaborator, as I said, Jean Jouvet, produced, directed, and starred as the rag picker. It's interesting that the male lead, who in this show is played by a woman, which I think works really well, given the kind of impersonation she does in Act Two, the male lead is not the love interest. The male lead is the rag picker, who's the sort of leader of the vagabond characters. The love interest is part of the subplot, and the subplot is very important to the play, but I think it's really interesting that it's not, the love story is secondary to the main event of the play, which I find that refreshing, actually. So it's not about this couple who are in love who sort of conquer evil. It's a more interesting and more unusual kind of story than that. The play was a tremendous success. Apparently Charles de Gaulle attended the premiere, and as I said, I think it's really sad that he was not there to see that his play was given this fantastic reception. It was understood that the rapacious corporate sharks who want to dig for oil under Paris were stand-ins for the Nazis, whose occupation of the City of Light and much of France caused such humiliation, hardship, and tragedy, especially for those in the resistance, and for the Jews, both French-born and those who had fled to France from other countries prior to the outbreak of war. So France became a magnet for Jews who were fleeing from Germany and Poland and other countries after the Nazi invasion. First sent to the transit camp of Drancy, northeast of Paris, approximately 65,000 people were shipped to their deaths at the Auschwitz-Birkenau and Sobibor killing centers. Giraudoux set the play aside after writing it with directions for it to be produced. As he said, on October 17, 1945, he picked a date when he was sure that the war would be won and the Nazis would be exiled from Paris. And as it turned out, it was presented on December 19, 1945, so he was off by 2 months. The Broadway production opened in 1948 at the Belasco Theater, and it ran until 1950. The Valency translation was directed by someone named Alfred de Liagre. John Carradine starred as the rag picker and Martita Hunt as the Countess, and she won a Tony Award. And Brooks Atkinson, who was a famous journalist, as you may have heard his name, for the New York Times, wrote the following, quote, "The play was a fantasy which is pure in heart and achieves through magic some of the conclusions that we cannot achieve in life. For a couple of guileless hours in the theater, the Madwoman of Chaillot disposes of evil with grace and humor in a spirit of civilized make-believe," unquote. And that's from the New York Times of January 9th, 49. And of course, it's easy to see what the play has to do with our time. The themes of corporate greed versus generosity of spirit, the disempowerment of the poor speak directly to us. The playwright seems to have foreseen many of the social issues the Western world is currently wrestling with: multinational corporate greed, class warfare, the loss of beauty, truth, and kindness in the age of neoliberal economic doctrine. We can imagine ourselves seated at the next table at Chez Francis, overhearing the corporate president, the baron, and the prospector as they conspire to destroy Paris in order to get at the lake of oil they want to believe lies underneath. Given all the stories of corporate raiders conspiring to violate the public trust by stripping retirement accounts, flouting environmental regulations, or embezzling public funds, and ruining the world's economy, as they did in the financial crisis of 2008. But things are even more pointed for us, I think you'll agree, in living in BC in 2017, living as we do in the era of the climate crisis, which is something that Giraudoux may not even have been able to imagine in 1943. When the Kinder Morgan pipeline expansion is set to begin, as well as massive legal challenges to it on the part of the Lower Mainland municipalities, various First Nations groups, and environmental groups, we are forced to take these figures of evil, who are the Nazis in a kind of corporate, you know, evildoer drag, bent on profit making regardless of the cost, at their face value. So for us, the metaphor has disappeared. The metaphor of them as Nazis is gone, and what we see is a corporate class that's completely out of control and bent on profit making, even though it will destroy the earth. When the prospector says, "They say where we pass, nothing ever grows again. What of it? Is a park any better than a coal mine? What's a mountain got that a slag pile hasn't? What would you rather have in your garden, an almond tree or an oil well?" Our thoughts after this speech turn to places like Montana and North Dakota with the whole Dakota Access Pipeline battle, and to Fort McMurray and all the sites in which fracking and horizontal drilling threaten to leave the land irreparably scarred and the water poisoned. So Trudeau signs the Paris Climate Accord, then comes back to Canada, and after a long process of deliberation, this is my opinion here, well, of course, a lot of this is my opinion, decides to sort of throw BC under the bus to buy votes in Quebec by canceling Energy East, and also to pacify Alberta and its very shaky NDP government, which wants to get their product to tidewater. It's always the phrase that they're using. So when we hear characters talk about there's oil under Paris and I'm going to dig it up, when a character says in 3 weeks' time you may see the city covered with derrickson drills, he's talking about Paris, but to me it could be Burnaby, because our people already have been arrested in terms of trying to stop, you know, bulldozers from starting various building that Kinder Morgan is beginning to engage in. So the debate continues about jobs and economic interests against environmentalists and conservationists who seek to leave the unspoiled wilderness untouched. Of course, the battle ought not to be about those two things. It ought to be about how we can make a whole new economy by living sustainably in the world. Now, because environmental issues are so at the forefront now, people are doing this play all over the place. It's become very popular, especially in schools, because we can do plays with 20 characters, whereas in the world of professional theater, it's very rare to find that. It's really rare to find a show that has more than 10 actors. That is really rare, which is a measure of how impoverished our theater culture is. It's actually very sad that our young playwrights are not learning how to work with big groups of characters. And recently, you may have seen The Children's Republic at the Belfry by Hannah Moscovich. Here's a very talented young playwright who wrote a play about this orphanage in the Warsaw Ghetto, where they were all taken away to Treblinka and killed, which is a terrible story. She basically did a play about this huge community story with two equity actors and five teenagers. So this play is very popular, not only because it's about issues that are of crucial importance to us right now, but also because it's great to put on shows with big casts. You get to show the whole sort of human community in miniature. So I see that I'm running out of time swiftly. It takes so much longer than you would think it would. A note on the production. I decided from the beginning that I was not going to try to set this play in realism. I don't do realism. I'm not really interested in realism. And I figured that my contribution I can make to the department is to do plays that are about a different way of doing theater, both for the students, for my colleagues, for the production teams, and for you, our audience. You get to see a different way from what you might be ordinarily used to seeing. So this play, I think, is usually done in realism, but it's a fantastic fable. As you'll see, it goes very quickly into the realm of the fantastic. So to me, it doesn't make any sense to do it in realism. And if you did, you'd have people sitting at a cafe where you've got people sitting at tables where people have their backs to the audience. It's going to be somebody who's basically doing a scene where they have their back to the audience. And you probably agree that it's not that interesting to have somebody with their back to the to you all the time, right? So I solved all these problems by having a set that was very obviously fake, by having set pieces that are moving, by putting chairs on wheels, by having actors move furniture around so that you're changing the set completely just to accommodate the sort of expressionistic fancy of the play. I wanted to serve what I think is the reality of the play by doing what I do, which is to work in a word the outside of realism. And this carries over to the costumes, which are very fantastical and beautifully made, beautifully designed and made. The lighting, again, supports all of this. So in this way, I'm sort of acknowledging the whole tradition of Bertolt Brecht, the name that you may have heard of, who is one of the sort of titanic figures of 20th century theater, who imagined a whole different way of doing theater, where we are, where the audience is meant to be a critical sort of spectator on a story that's meant to engage them, not just entertain them, so that actors are engaging with their roles in a very different way than we do in the realistic play. So what you'll see is actors, you'll see the space between the actor and their role, and you'll see the sort of dynamic interplay between those things. The vagabonds, to me, are, there's no way they could plausibly show up and have these interactions as they do. To me, the vagabonds had to be a chorus. They had to be on stage as a chorus. They had to engage in the kinds of things that choruses do. And that's another way that I have sort of turned the dial away from the realistic. I had way more to tell you about, but it's interesting to go back to all my directing notes and to discover all the ways in which I was able to realize the things that I thought might work for this production. So I have to pause now and actually ask you, would you like to ask, do you have any questions about any of this at all? Now that I've blasted you with this torrent of verbiage.
I got a question.
Yeah.
Part of your extraction is Polish, and
yeah.
Obviously what the Russians did to them, to Poland wasn't very nice.
Right.
And obviously the famine in the Ukraine wasn't very nice.
Mm-hmm.
So is it not possible to debate that the Nazis were the worst form of evil in the world history?
Yes. Yes, certainly. And given what happened in China as well, I guess that the point to take away from this is that the human capacity for evil doing and violence is just sort of seemingly limitless. It's just that the Nazis, it was such a highly mechanized, it has a particular kind of quality that people tend to look to it as iconic of sort of state-sponsored evil. But I fully agree with you that, I know a lot more about this than maybe a lot of people do because of my family's background that I've sort of undertaken to look into this stuff, that there was a whole other kind of Holocaust that was of Soviet prisoners of war. 3 1/3 million Soviet prisoners of war were allowed to die of exposure or just starve to death. But it's true that the famine that was engineered in the Ukraine was appalling. And of course, that is something that most people don't know anything about. So that's a really good point. Anybody? Yes.
So what was your inspiration to come to theater and teach?
My inspiration to come to theater? Well, I actually come from a dance background. So I had always loved to dance to music. And when I was growing up, I didn't even know what dance was and didn't know that boys weren't supposed to do it. So through a very circuitous route, I found my way to dance training at York University, where I did my BFA in dance, and then I became a professional dancer. And then I began choreographing and doing very theatrical work and writing texts for dance. I began doing this was all in here, but I didn't get to it. So I began doing physical theater that involved working with actors and dancers together in different ways. And I began moving gradually more into a theatrical territory, but I sort of carried all my dance sensibility with me. So I got an MFA in directing in 2002 from the University of Alberta. And then I began looking for jobs. I wanted to get a teaching position, and I'm in my 10th year here. So I sort of bridge, I bridge the territory between dance and theater. That's what I do. Yeah. Anybody else? Okay. Well, thank you so much for coming, and I really hope you enjoyed the show. Thank you.